Hello, good evening, and you're very welcome along to our Life and Times programme here in Midlands 103. And this evening, I'm delighted to welcome one of Ireland's best-known actresses. Indeed, we're just off air. I was telling her how much I almost grew up with her character of Biddy England Rowe. She's from originally the county of Westmeath, Mary McAvoy. You're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
And thank you so much for coming in.
Not at all.
And must I say, you look great.
Well, thank you very much, yes.
How are things anyway?
Good. Everything is the book is ticking over. I'm doing a little bit of theatre. I'm doing little bits of everything at the moment.
We might catch up on that in a little while. Can I take it back, though? You're originally from Delvin in County Westmeath.
That's right, yeah.
What was Delvin like as a young one?
Oh, it was great. I loved it.
Describe it for our listeners. What's Delvin like?
Well, it's a town of one street, like most villages in Ireland, I suppose. And I don't know whether the community is close-knit or not, but I liked everybody I've ever met there, you know. I was always a person who kind of lived slightly outside.
And you're still living there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But always, I would just, you know, I've never moved, really.
Take us back to the McAvoys, though. Like, who was your dad?
My dad was Larry McAvoy. And he, again, another long line of McAvoys in that area. And he had a farm. And my mother was from Terrell's Pass, Ring, Catherine Morgan.
Right.
And
what were they like?
Well, my mum was a very, my father was a sort of, what would you call it, earthy, stocky, stern kind of man. He had a great
old
sense.
Stock.
Old stock. But, yeah. You know, absolute central casting Irish farmer, you know. And great sense of humour, but, you know, quite strict and, you know, like everybody was in those days, you know, very religious.
Knew the value of everything.
Absolutely. And very religious and very conservative.
Because you were an only child, Mary.
Yeah.
How did that sit with you?
Never bothered me because my mother's side of the family, the Morgans, had a lot of cousins from that side, and they would come and stay with me.
Because they weren't that far away, Terrell's Pass up to
Terrell's Pass and Crohan, up in just over the border in Offaly, and just under Crohan Hill there. My auntie Eily still lives there, and Michael Killian, how he is, if he's are listening. And my cousins, the Killians or the Maloneys or the Morgans, they would all come down. The Morgans live in still in Terrell's Pass and also in Kilbeggan. So I'm from all of my sort of mother's side of the family come from that, around that area. So I was always had cousins and I had friends living up and down the road, the Kellys.
So you weren't lonely?
No, I wasn't lonely at all. To me, it was what I knew, so I didn't
think or dwell on it.
It wasn't a time of, in those days, wasn't a time where there was any kind of self-reflection. You know, nowadays on the radio, everybody examines everything, you know, and it's always people writing about their experiences or talking about their experiences. No, it wasn't like that. So you just got on with it. I had no idea that it was any different for me than anyone else.
And what class of a farm was it, Mary?
It's a sort of dry stock and sheep and cattle. I mean, at that time it was, you know, very much a hive of industry, you know, like you'd have the thresher in every autumn and, you know, when you'd have, I mean, we're still using horses. It was a tractor, but we still had dray horses and stuff like that.
Did you have to work in the farm yourself, obviously?
No, I didn't. I was kind of, well, like I was such a, like, I was very young up until, you know, I mean, when I went to school then at 11, then, you know, the way to boarding school, then everything changed and I'd come back. Like,
of course, everybody
changed.
The norm would go off to boarding school anyway. Where did you go to school?
I went to school in Navan, in Loretta Navan.
How did you find that?
I found that tough, I have to say, because I was away from home and I'd never left home before. And it was my mother was very concerned that I wouldn't get too locked into being at home because she was very much a career woman. She'd become a nurse and had gone to England and done nursing in England. And at that time, that was a fairly brave thing to do.
Yes.
And so she was very independent person and wanted me to be so as well.
Were you a good student?
I think I was. I think I probably underachieved a bit, but I think I was. I never really thought whether I was good or bad. I was always up sort of at I was never number one, shall we say, but I'd be number two or three in the class and did various things. Mum, of course, always wanted me to be number one, but I mean, the only thing I really, really couldn't do and still can't do to this day is maths. I mean, I'm almost innumerate in that sense.
You see, you're a creative person. You're not supposed to do maths.
No, but I actually do think there is, and I think somebody said it now, that there is actually some kind of thing that's like, it's a numeric version of dyslexia, where, I mean, once I got into you know, algebra and all that, I hadn't a clue.
Meet your brother. Yeah. Algorithms and this, that and the other. Having been talking a different
time. And they were completely pointless. If somebody actually gave you a point to doing it, and for some reason it was going to be have anything to do with anything.
Yeah, work out the change of 2 points in algorithms and ogives and all the rest of it.
I know, and I had, and pi, what the hell was pi?
Pi was something that you got after
exactly,
the dinner.
Exactly, exactly. And I didn't know what that was.
Did you adjust the school? How long were you in boarding school?
5 years.
And did you adjust to it? Like,
Yeah, I did. I mean, in the end, you know, like, you get used to everything and you grow into it. And in a way, it was a very good thing for
and
me.
And were you allowed home fairly often, or...?
Not the way they are now, no. I mean, you'd be waiting, say, when you go back from the summer holidays, you'd be waiting your 6 weeks till midterm break, and then there'd be another 6 weeks till Christmas.
And would the parents come up and see you during the school term?
Yes, we were allowed visits on a Sunday. But I
was this like the parcel from home with the bits and pieces?
That kind of thing, yeah. And you'd be going out and you'd sit in the car, or might go for a drive. And I might, but it's Navan. I mean, it was Navan. I might have been in Madagascar, do you know what I mean? I just wanted to go home, you know, because I loved my home so much.
So when you finished up there, what did you do next?
I went home. I went home. Did I? I went home for Scottish all. I went home for a year.
Back onto the farm. And
back onto the farm. And then...
Did you know what you wanted to be at that stage, Mary?
No. No. I mean, I always thought I'd...
What were your friends doing?
What were my friends... I think everybody sort of went into the civil service and that. And I mean, you know, I think people went to... Yeah, I think so. I mean, it was very much, you know, do your secretarial course, get a secretarial job, work
get
for a
husband.
Few years, get married. You know, that was... Practically everybody did that.
And it's not that long ago.
It isn't that long ago. No, it isn't. But that's the way it was. I mean, Ireland changed enormously, absolutely enormously.
Did somebody say then that you ended up going back to Dublin or going up to Dublin working for the Department of Agriculture?
I did in the end. I decided I loved rock music, and see, in those days everybody listened to country and Irish down there, and I didn't like country and Irish. Now, I mean, I'm sorry, I'm not making a value judgment about it, it's just not my cup of tea.
That's not your cup of tea.
And so I used to have my ears stuck to Radio Luxembourg or Radio Paris.
Like the rest of us, under the sheets, the whole lot.
Yeah, and it was the time, you know, where there was a great big world out there and I wanted to see it. And at one stage, because I did like writing, I liked to write, even back then I liked to write. And I was always sort of writing short stories and stuff like that. So I thought that what I would love to actually do is be a rock journalist, you know. Because I used to read the NME and the New Musical Express and Melody Maker and all those things. So that'd be great.
So how would you go about making that happen?
Well, I went up and got a job in, because Dublin's the only place to be. Because really, even Horslips hadn't happened at that time. And Horslips are really what kind of cracked.
The
sort
whole
of
rock
broke
thing,
up
yes.
the sort of show band stranglehold on Irish entertainment. And so I went up to Dublin and got a job in the civil service in a laboratory testing for brucellosis. Couldn't get away from the farm, of course. And then I would go to gigs every single night.
Who were the happening bands at the time?
Oh my God. Well, you see, no, Monday night was blues in Mourne's Hotel in Talbot Street.
Yeah.
And that would be Red Peters and people like that, and Jimmy Faulkner and all of those guys. Well, Jimmy Faulkner turned up in everything. And then Tuesday nights was the Universal, I think. Tuesday nights was the Universal, and that was a folk session. And that was in Parnell Square. Wednesdays might be Toners in Baggot Street. Thursdays was the Coffee Kitchen. And Thursdays was the rock night
It sounds like you had a wonderful and varied nightlife.
Oh yeah, we never
out all the time.
Out all the time. I was going to music, but I was passionate about it at the time. But I forgot all about writing because I just got into having a good time, like anyone would when they went up to Dublin and, you know, going to that. I mean, some of the dives I ended up in, my God, I was thinking, God, thank God I don't have children, because if they ever ended up in some of the places I ended up in and thought nothing of it.
But that was the scene, though, wasn't
it? That was a scene, and I was a serious scene person, do you know? I mean, there was a place called Zero's in Mary Street in Dublin, I'm telling you. All of human life was there. You wouldn't die wondering if you went into zeros, I can tell you.
You'd see the likes of it in Berlin, huh?
It's very much like that. Very much like that.
So, you were working away testing for brucellosis or tuberculosis.
Or as somebody put on the, I don't know whether I can say this on air, but sure. Somebody put on the on one of the bags sent in was bull's balls. Was
anyway. So what was the next step? Like, I mean, how did you, like, when did the acting start? Or did it start around that time?
No,
or
I came home for a while.
Did you get to do the writing? Or?
No. I then got into amateur drama. And then that sort of, I never realised that people could become an actor in Ireland. I mean, I was so far away. You know, nowadays, show business is so close to people. All, you know, everybody knows how the whole thing happens. Everyone does.
It was like a mystery back in the
old
days.
Yeah, those days, I didn't even know that there were places that you could act in Ireland. I didn't know. I just genuinely didn't know. I mean, it never dawned on me about
it. So how did it happen then?
Well, I just went back up. I came home to try and manage the farm. I realised it wasn't what I wanted to do, and I went back up to Dublin again.
How were your mum and dad about this?
Oh, they didn't like it. Of course, they didn't like it. They wanted me to come home. Yeah, and they wanted me to stay.
Settle down.
Well, settle down. It was more just, I think, because I was an only child, they were very attached to me. Mm. But I would come home every single weekend. I mean, that was not a weekend I didn't miss.
Right.
And so anyway, I went back up and I got a job as a runner for the Dublin Theatre Festival, putting up posters and bringing, you know, because again, those days...
Working on the fringe of it, yes.
Yeah, the fringes and... Well, it wasn't the fringe, it was the whole festival, but like, I'd go up and I'd have to do posters one day, I'd have to run with a message. Those days, there wasn't emails, there was no mobile phones, all of that sort of thing. So I was the runner. And through that, then, I kind of got into the sort of, what would you call it, the sort of round of theatre gossip and see learn about gigs or courses or
who's doing
whatever
what,
was
where,
going.
How,
I mean, once you got into the loop, that was the word I was looking for. Mm. I got into the loop and then I heard about this course that was been given in the Oscar Theatre School, which was a professional theatre course. And I ended up going and doing that. It was 2 years. It was the first professional theatre course there was ever, but it wasn't full time. It was 2 years of weekend courses.
Did you have to pay for it, or was it available?
Oh,
was
no,
it
no,
free?
No, you had to pay for it.
You had to pay for it,
yeah.
And how did you raise the cash for that?
Well, I was working at the time, right. See, then, because I got into, I started working in a shop then called the Craftsman's Guild in Powerscourt Townhouse.
Still trading away? Didn't close down after you?
Did it not?
No, it's still there.
Where is it? I went up there a while ago in the Craftsman's Guild.
Oh, the Powerstown.
Oh, the, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, that's flying. Yeah. Didn't manage to close it yet. Anyway, yeah, so that's what I did there. And then I paid. And then, of course, obviously, I didn't work at the weekends. And like my boss was kind of annoyed at me because it was a craft shop, you see. And so.
Busy at the weekend.
But also, it was crafts and it was about promoting crafts, so you weren't just a shop assistant, you were supposed to be kind of on the team and promoting crafts. And you know, my boss was kind of saying, well, yeah, there's a choice whether you're into promoting crafts or you want to be an actress. So I was kind of pushed.
So you spent two years at doing the course. Mm. And so what happened then? How did you kind of turn
out of that 2 years? Because Chris O'Neill at the time played, well, he didn't at that time, but he had played Michael Reardon in the Reardons, but he was a very well known theatre agent and man around town, kind of great guy, great fun. Mm-hmm. Bit of a divil, you know, fun and lovely man. But he, at the time, I think he was on the board of the Gate, and he had one of the rewards at the end of this theatre thing would have been that we would get a chance at an audition in the Gate for something. So there was an audition for The Philanderer by George Bernard Shaw, and I auditioned and I got the role, the ingenue role.
Tell us a little bit about just, you know, an audition. I mean, here you are now, a wonderfully experienced actress.
You still have to do auditions. I did an audition last week. You know,
yeah.
That's what you have to do.
But I suppose, I mean, now that you kind of take them, but going in for the first kind of auditions, I mean, what's it like?
God, it's so long ago. I suppose, you see, it's the sort of arrogance of youth, I suppose. It wasn't that I was going to get it, or it wasn't that I wasn't going to get it. I just went in, I just did it. I can't even recall being nervous. I can't even recall who I did it with.
Do you get nervous when you go in for auditions now?
No, because you know now what is. You either have the look, if you can act at all, and you look right, basically. It was filmed.
What about this kind of X factor that they're looking at? You never know what it is, though.
Oh, well, you never know. Yeah. You know, and it'll all depend. you know, I don't think you ever know what it is. I mean, I often want, because I'm so kind of laid back about the whole thing now. I mean, maybe I just don't look hungry enough when I go into an audition, because I kind of go, who gets the part gets the part. I'm not going to lose my sleep over it.
Okay.
You know, but and it doesn't mean that I don't want it, and it doesn't mean that I wouldn't work 105% if I got it. But it just means I'm not gonna, I have a life to live, and if I was to lose my reason over every audition I did, it wouldn't be worth living. So I just kind of
no, it's a good attitude and a good point to have.
Yeah.
I think what we need to do, we need to take a short commercial break. It's Life and Times, it's Midlands 103, and this evening's guest is Mary McAvoy. We'll be right back in just 2 minutes' time. You're very welcome back. It's Life and Times, it's Mary McAvoy. Mary, before the break, we had got up, you were doing a George Bernard Shaw play. What was the part? Can you
remember? Sylvia Craven, and she was basically, it was the ingenue part, as they call it, the juve lead. And no, I wasn't the lead, the only juve in it. And it was, you know, she was a mouthy young one, basically, who thought she was a suffragette. And that was basically all it was. It was the typical Shaw, you know.
And, like, you know, they say that actors and actresses, like, it's a hungry business to be in, because work comes along every now and then. And the pay, unless you're really up in the higher echelons, isn't great.
Yeah, no, it's not, but I think
that didn't deter you at the time, did it?
But you see, in my day, it was a calling, I think. You know, I mean, nowadays, people want to be famous. And they think acting is going to do it for them. Do you know what I mean? Whereas in those days, people just wanted to act. And they were very, you know, and I mean, there are still many, many actors in Dublin and around the country who are very almost monastic about it. They are very purist about their craft and everything else. So it wasn't always about the money. And I think people, you see, at that time when you're, again, and when you're younger, money means less to you in that sense that you're proud. Like, I mean, I remember at one stage, and sort of people are laughing, you know, an only child of a farmer, what the hell was she doing? You know, like, could she not ask for money at home? But I never did. I never, ever asked for money at home. I never borrowed from my parents, ever. I supported myself the whole way through. But I remember I was staying in this dingy little flat in Whitworth Road with Martina Stanley, who's one of my best friends, who plays Dolores in Fair City now, and we're good pals, and we shared at the time. And but I remember hunting down the back of the sofa for money to buy a sandwich. I mean, but it didn't matter. I kind of enjoyed it, and I found loads of old books, and I went and sold them. They were old medical books, and I sold them, and I thought I was going to make a fortune because they were antiques. But apparently they weren't. They were just old, but not in any way remarkable. So I got the price of a sandwich for them.
What other, in terms of your acting jobs then, okay, you started off with this George Bernard Shaw. Where did you go on to from that? Like, was it just lots of other parts?
Well, you see, it was kind of, you got onto a rolling thing then, which was the next show. And what they would do, normally in those days, is that if there was anything that suited you in the next show, you would be cast. Because they would, if you were in the show at night, they didn't have to pay you for rehearsing, you see.
Okay.
Because it fell in within the hours.
But were the parts getting better and bigger?
No, they it would depend on what was there, because the next show I think that went in was Semi-Private, which was Mary Halpin had won the Irish Times Theatre. They had the new playwright of the year or something, and the award was the production of this play in the Gate. So I ended up playing a much smaller part than the Sylvia Craven part, because I wasn't suitable for anything
else. So when did your big break come? Like, when was the first kind of size?
See, an actor would have said my big break came when, like, as the actor in me, and any actor else would say, would have been my first play in the Gate, because that, to a lot of people, would be the biggest break. And I suppose the big break came, if you like, about a year. I was very, very lucky, about a year into my professional career when I got Glenroe.
Yeah. How did you think of applying for Glenroe, or did somebody ask you to go for it?
I didn't, I just heard by accident, and I just, then you go in for every audition you heard for, if you just got in and got an audition, and that was it.
Okay, but, like, I mean, Biddy McDermott, wasn't it? It was a huge part, like, it was a pivotal part in the whole thing.
But it only became a huge part. At that stage, nobody knew what it was, they just knew it was a new soap.
Well, this was a run-on from Bracken, wasn't it?
I mean,
Gabriel
Byrne and
all these. Were they?
Well, no, the Dinny and the Miley characters weren't new. They came, but everybody else was new. So this was all.
So you didn't have an idea of how this was going to.
No, no. In actual fact, RTE hadn't intended for it to last.
Wesley Burroughs, was it?
That's
was
right. Who wrote Bracken as well?
Yes.
And the Reardons.
Okay. But did somebody say that you only got the part because you had a license to drive a tractor?
No, I said that I was only the third choice anyway. But I'd say what swung it was they didn't have to teach me to drive a tractor, because I knew how to drive a tractor.
Right.
So I think, you know, but that's what happens.
Okay.
It's not like, you know, the acting, Hollywood and showbiz on television is not like it really is. It's a lot more ordinary than that. Do you know? It likes to make itself look extraordinary, but it's not. Mm. You know, it's
in terms of the character, you played a character, I think, for about 18 years.
16 years.
16 years. So how did all the other acting jobs, were there other acting jobs while you were still doing
Yeah, I did loads of theatre. And in fact, I did the first performance ever of Bolia Gongora, which I personally think is one of the finest plays in the English language, if not the finest play in the English language, by Tom Murphy and with Siobhan McKenna. I did that, and I did Wood of the Whispering. Now, both of those were Druid, and I did more stuff in The Gate, and I did stuff for the theatre festival. And, you know, I would work every year within the break, you'd work.
So it, just, I suppose, out of curiosity more than anything, the Biddy character, unfortunately or fortunately, you're always going to be synonymous with Biddy. And I'm sure that people would, even when they're talking, to say, well, Mary, the next time they're talking, might be saying Biddy.
Mm. But I'll just clarify one thing. And I am very careful. I always just say, if somebody calls me Biddy, I just say Mary, right? Mm. That's fine. It's no problem to me. And I don't worry, and I'm not annoyed when they call me Biddy, but I like the right to say, actually, my name is Mary.
Yes.
But the other day, I went up and I met Dave Duffy, who from Fair City, and I know him, and I know him long before Fair City, and I called him Leo.
Mea culpa.
I rest my case. You know.
So the work itself, outside the character, but the work itself, how long would you have to work to get a series in place?
I think nowadays Fair City's work rate is just phenomenal. I don't know what they put together in a week. But we were luxurious. We had like a week to make an episode or two. Yeah, a week in it.
Yeah, it was only once a week it was on.
And there'd be rehearsal for a week and then shooting for a week, and that was two episodes. But now the workload is just unbelievable.
Oh yeah, but sorry, just trying to get a grasp. Like, how many months of the year would you require to work in Glenroe? Because it was an autumn programme, wasn't it?
It was an autumn programme, and at one stage we shot through the summer. I can't remember. And then they decided that it was ridiculous because they shot through the summer, but they would follow the year, if you know what I mean. So the Christmas episode being in July or some ridiculous thing. And then they decided...
You'd be lambing in the wrong time of the year.
Exactly, and that was absolutely ridiculous. So they decided then they would change it and shoot it in the season. So then it went from sort of September to the end of May, and you'd have 3 months off, and then it all started
well. The success of the series is well documented, and the success of your character Biddy is well documented. And just two or three just last questions on that. When you decided to leave, you decided you'd had enough, and they then came with the exit mechanism out of it, which was at the time a car crash. Mm. Remember you reaching down for the cuddly toy or something like that, whatever. Mm. How did you feel at that stage? Did you feel kind of a sense of relief that it's, oh God, I'm out of here now, and at least that character's gone, it won't be coming back? Or did you feel it sad?
It was a weird one because Glenroe was terribly, was my family, and it was everything. You know, it was my second family, and I loved them dearly, and I loved everything about it dearly.
Was it hard to walk away from that?
No, yes, it was, yeah. I mean, really, really technically, you know, if I was talking to my younger self now, I would have said get out much earlier.
Well, it was the beginning of the end, because I think Joe Lynch, the Dinny character, left a year or so after.
Oh, the writing was on the wall. I didn't know. I mean, I honestly didn't think. I thought they'd get another 3 years out of it. I thought they'd round it off to the 20. I really did think they would. I didn't think, and I didn't get out because I thought the writing was on the wall. I just got out because I knew, you know, the way sometimes you have this thing and you just know.
Fair play to you, the courage of your own convictions to get out when you want it.
I was really shocked myself and very upset when it was axed.
Yeah.
Very upset.
Did you watch the last episode as it went out?
No.
You've obviously watched it at some stage, have you?
Of my episode?
Yes.
No, I've never seen it.
Haven't you?
Oh, no, I never watched it.
Haven't you? Okay.
No, I watched it. I became a fan afterwards.
Right.
Because you don't want to be criticising your own
You mentioned there that it would act like a family. Of course, we've now seen, I mean, Joe Lynch has gone now 9 years, I think it is, almost 10 years.
Yeah.
And Mick Lally, of course.
Yeah.
Poor Mick, an amazing actor and a wonderful, warm character.
Yeah.
I mean, you must have been really sad.
Devastated, but like nothing compared to his real family, you know.
Yeah.
I have chats now on the phone with his mum, who's an absolute dote. She's just the loveliest woman. And I chat to Peggy, his wife, the odd time, and all of that. And they're doing okay. They're a strong family, you know. But they miss him terribly because he wasn't like a, you know, he wasn't one of these kind of golf playing fathers.
Yes.
Or whatever. He was an absolute. That's where his.
There was a real touch of decency about him, even when he was being interviewed, yeah, or when you met him.
But
or
he was very.
He was McLally. That was, yeah, it.
Like, he was very familiar. Like, that's where he got his buzz, was from his family.
Mm-hmm.
He would never want a night away from the family, you know. Is the greatest night of his life, or the best night to go out, would be to go out with Peggy and the kids if possible, or just better still to stay in with them. And that was his thing. That was his thing. He just loved that. And, you know, that was his number one. So, I mean, I was his friend and his colleague.
You got on
and
well.
I miss him terribly, but nothing compared to what they must have been.
What year did you finish? What year did your character exit?
I think it was 2000 it must have been, because I remember I went to New York with the play straight after that, and the Twin Towers were still there.
Well, that was my next question. So obviously, yeah, but 2010 then, so 11 odd years.
Mm.
It doesn't seem like that, does it?
No.
It doesn't.
No.
So what happened then, you know, like in terms of your career, what did you go on to do after that?
Well, I went to New York with the Gingerman. That went to New York to the Irish Arts Centre there and played there for 2 months. And then I came home and I went into a play with Red Kettle down in Waterford.
Great, and yes, well, very well known.
Yeah,
and then
I kind of decided, you know, I probably wouldn't ever work again, you know. I did a course in TEFL, teaching English as a foreign language, because I reckoned that, you know, how, like, I can't go back, I can't wait tables, I can't do anything in the public eye, because it'd be going, oh, look at your woman or whatever, and it'd be just too much.
Mm-hmm.
To, but if I was teaching foreign students, I wouldn't have the ghost of biddy.
Yes.
So
yes.
I reckon that was a pretty good thing,
yeah,
to do.
Okay.
So I did that, and I did a course, and I taught for a year. And I also then presented, because I went into presenting then, I presented the Friday edition of Mary and Marty, what was it called?
The Afternoon Show.
The Afternoon Show. Well, this wasn't the Afternoon Show then, but
didn't really watch enough of it.
Yeah, and I did that. We did it. There was a Friday magazine show I did with Tom Branigan.
Mm.
I did that. And then I got into the Chastitute. Well, I was asked to come into the Chastitute. With Mick, John B. Keane, and that was, I think, one of the biggest grossing tours ever in the history of Irish theatre. We played to 12,000 people one night, 1,200 people in the NEC. We packed the NEC for a week in Killarney. So that was unusual for anyone to do, but for a play to do.
So, Miria, as an actor, is
local,
is like,
local
is
man, Lord de Marston, Edward Farrell produced it.
Yes,
from Athlone.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. You know, as an actor, is your big buzz going on stage? Is that your preferred meet? No, what is? What is?
Getting paid to do sweet FA is basically what I'd like to do now.
But I mean, surely as an actor, you have to have an ego. Like, I mean, you have to.
I don't anymore. No,
you don't anymore. You did have.
Not really, even not.
But
even
how do you get up and get out there and do it?
Just because it's a kind of a calling. It's what you do. It's like, why does somebody like to fix cars? Why does?
But do you like, you know, when you get that applause from the an appreciative audience, you take the bow. Does that tingle through you? Isn't
it? No. To be very honest, no. I mean, it's not that I'm not grateful. It's not that I don't appreciate being appreciated. It's not that. It's that I'm the kind of person who will say, yeah, this is lovely. I love this. This is great. And I'm enjoyed for this moment. But I know that tomorrow will be different. It may be better or worse. And I always feel, and particularly today with all that's going on, I feel there is a woman somewhere on the outskirts of Mogadishu, losing a child at this very moment we're talking, from hunger and thirst.
Mm.
And I go, this doesn't matter a crap. Do you know? It doesn't. That's what I think. Now, I don't go on and I will go and I'll try and help by giving some money or something to concern. I'm not going to end haunted by this person. But there's no point in being, you know, isn't this wonderful? Do you know? Because it
kind
is nice in its
it?
Time, and it's nice. It's nice to make people laugh, and I love to see people laugh. And I mean, there were times doing The Matchmaker with Mick Lally when you'd be right up nose to nose with the audience. I remember once in the garage in Monaghan, we were doing The Matchmaker, and I'll always remember it because both of us remarked on this woman. She was incredibly elegant, sitting in the front row. Like if you were kind of putting a name on her, you'd say she was the wife of the Italian ambassador, or maybe the Italian ambassador. You know, that kind of really glamorous, very, you know, big gold jewellery, gorgeous looking woman. I said, oh God, you know, she's a real glamour puss. She's not going to like this. Well, she was crying with the laughter. She had a packet of tissues and she was roaring. And you get to that stage where it's almost like ecstasy, where you're kind of just there and the audience are so with you that they're ahead of you, if you know what I mean.
Yes, yes.
So they start laughing because they know what's coming, and then they laugh even more because it is what they're expecting. And they're magical moments.
So are you suggesting then that maybe you like comedy?
It's not that I like the moment when you actually
connect.
When you know there's a silence, or you know you've got them, or you know, and you get them in different ways, do you know? But I suppose I'm a long time at it now. And it's not that I don't enjoy it, and it's not that I suppose it is, and I'm glad that I still get the opportunity to work when so many people
We have to take another commercial break, and that's the next part, is I want to find out what you're doing now and how life is going for you at the moment. So with that, it's another commercial break. It's Life and Times. It's Mary McAvoy, and we'll be right back. Midlands 103's Life and Times, and it's Mary McAvoy. Mary, how's life with you at the moment?
Busy. Very busy.
Doing what?
Oh, everything. A little bit of everything.
Tell me. I
wrote the book.
Tell us about the book.
Well, I was asked to write the book based on the Would You Believe programme that I did about 2 years ago, and I was asked by Hachette Press would I write the book. So I wrote the book, promoted the book.
How did it sell?
Oh, very well. Thank God. It's still doing well. How the light gets in, go out and buy it. It's doing very well. It's coming out in paperback later on in the year. I don't follow, you see, I don't. I just put the things out and I go then, that's somebody else's, and if somebody wants me to publicise it, I'll do that. But I'm not somebody who goes on ringing up and finding out how my book is doing. Maybe I should, but I don't. And then I lambed the sheep in the spring, and I promoted the book in the spring, and then I did a tour in the spring. And then I do my midday gig. I do midday. I'm a sort of regular panellist on midday on TV3. And I'm an agony aunt on the Tom Dunne Show on News Talk.
Today, News Talk, sorry.
News
yes,
Talk,
good
yeah.
station, yeah.
And
what kind of agony aunt? Is the sort of, my boyfriend is...
That sort of thing, yeah. They seem to like my take on life.
I'd be afraid now to ask you an agony aunt kind of question, because you're sort of the woman that might slap me up the arse and tell me to go and cop myself on.
Well, I might if I felt that was needed. But
are you that blunt?
No. I mean, you never know. You never know with people. Because some people write in and you'd kind of go, oh my God, these people should be, you know, ringing a doctor or something. But so you have to be very careful. You know
what's
what I mean?
The weirdest stuff you get?
Oh, we haven't got anything really weird. No, we don't get anything weird. We get real.
But do you do it in a character or do you do it as Mary McAvoy?
Oh, no, it's proper straightforward. Real letters in and a proper answer. Myself and Tom will tease out the answer, you know.
Do you enjoy that?
I enjoy it. I mean, I take it quite seriously. I mean, it's light. I mean, they don't ring in with like very serious life-threatening problems, but or not really writing or texting, I should say. But, you know, I take it very seriously, and any answer that they get will have been considered by me.
Fair
you know?
Play. Okay.
And I wouldn't ever go, cop yourself off. I mean, sometimes there might be somebody who, you know, says my wife doesn't look after me enough or whatever. It might be something, or the vice versa. I don't know. But I would be very careful about telling anybody to cop themselves on because, you know.
You're such an influencer, yeah.
Well, but also it is, you know, you having suffered from depression myself and suffered from sort of, you know, this mental unease, shall we say, I'm quite careful about causing.
You're known to be quite candid about your depression.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not you tend to just throw it out there and deal with it on the table and stuff.
Yeah.
Like when did it hit you? Or
I think you know it was there for a long time before I was diagnosed. You know, I got diagnosed by a psychiatrist because I kept on dodging the, and you know, just felt, you know, I wasn't just working hard enough to keep myself together, and that was it. And I was just generally not worth the paper I was printed on.
Even though with all your success and all your stuff you get over.
But that's outer success, do you know? I mean, I personally feel you could get 97 Oscars and 300 BAFTAs and all that. And because the way I think, I'd be still thinking about the woman in Mogadishu, do you know?
Yeah.
And I don't.
What's it all worth, or why are we here, kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I don't really. I would be delighted with it, and maybe probably feel a little bit bolstered up by it. But in the end, it is all smoke and mirrors.
But how do you deal with it?
How do I deal with?
How do you deal with the depression?
I just live every day with it, and you know, I up my medication, I down my medication, and
have you reached a compromise with it? Like, where
no, I think it's an ongoing thing because life changes all the time. Mm. I mean, you know, and your life condition changes all the time. You know, you can be, you know, well, for me, I wasn't married and I didn't have children, but that if you do suffer from depression, if you get
but
married,
you,
and
but you strike me as a very kind of pragmatic kind of person and a kind of and a strong.
Well, I think
person.
That's probably why I can live with it because I am pragmatic. Mm. You know, I think you know it's that thing of. You know, it's almost like God says, I didn't promise you a rose garden. You know, I mean, I've never expected life to be perfect.
Yeah, but you definitely come across as somebody like things don't really faze you. You know, you just
they do faze me, but I will find some way of working around them, you know.
Mm.
No, I get fazed on a daily basis by things, you know. I don't get fazed by show business at all. I could be having one of my total depression conniptions and I could play the Albert Hall no problem, and that would be the one place I wouldn't be nervous.
Right,
I come off stage, I get nervous.
Like you said, you're not married, but you're in a very long term relationship.
Yeah,
what's his name?
Garvin.
Yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't like his name being mentioned. You know, he doesn't like being.
Well, hello,
anyway,
Garvin.
But yeah, no, that's all grand. That's all fine. No, it's real life. I find the problem with I could work anywhere. I could do Radio City Music Hall. It wouldn't bother me.
Fair
and I wouldn't be nervous. But I'd walk off stage and I'd start shaking. And that's where it happens.
In terms then of, I mean, you know, in terms of choosing how and when you want to work, how do you manage that?
You don't choose. I mean, that's what I'd say to anyone going into.
So do you have an agent?
An agent and all of that. But I mean, I root out an awful lot of the work myself. But like anyone who thinks, you know, you go into show business and you hit it big and you do, you know, you work for 16 years nonstop, but that's the way it's always going to be. It's not always that way, particularly in Ireland, unless you have an international name.
But like, you're obviously very good at it because, you know, it's such a small little country. And as a consequence of a small country, it's a small circle. So you must be continually delivering to get more work.
Well, I'd say, you know, I mean, a lot of it would be the fact. I mean, I know that when I mean, because I obviously haven't played Biddy for the last 11 years. Mm. I've played many, many different characters from Shirley Valentine to Mamie in the Field. But I think the fact that I have been in Glenroe would be a bums on seats thing. But I think that if you're not able to do your job, they're not going to be happy. You know, they're not coming to see Biddy. They're actually coming. They're not Egypts. They're coming to see a play.
Yes.
You know, so if you're not good at your job, they won't come. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I do think that the fact that my face is well known and that my name is well known can't hurt. But, you know, there are people who are well known. And don't bring in crowds. I do think that the whole Biddy Miley thing, I mean, with the matchmaker, you know, that was the thing where we were together in that.
Hmm.
But, I mean, as characters, in the matchmaker, we could not have been more different. I mean, the character I played 9 or 7, 10 characters in the matchmaker, as did Mick, Lord Mercenary, but like one of the characters, Fionnuala Crost, I mean, was just a psychopath. And there was not one character in all of the, I don't know how many, 20 characters are there in, that were anywhere remotely like Biddy and Miley, you know.
Yes.
But people got it because people aren't stupid, because I come on several times through the course of the play as Fionnuala Crost. And by the end, they're going, oh, here she comes again. So it's not, oh, here's Biddy coming again. So they're into the Fionnuala narrative. And I think most of the people are like that. And I mean, I've never had to struggle keep them.
What are you working at the moment?
Well, I've just done a documentary for RTE presenting a little piece about Lunasa, which is going to be going out on the 31st of July.
What time?
The Feast of Lunasa. I don't know
if
you can tell me.
Keep an
but
eye
I mean,
for
it's not just me. They're going to do a live broadcast from Clare, and I'll be there. Mm. And I've done a little bit about Lunasa from up in Cavan and that. Then I'll be going out on tour later in the autumn with a play called Fruitcake. And
what's that about?
It's a play written by a woman from Cork called Alice Barry, and it was written primarily for the Bealtaine Festival, which is the festival of arts for the older people. But it's basically about this woman. It's about a fruitcake, making a fruitcake, basically. She's a woman who's, sanely insane, shall we say, or insanely sane. But she's a woman with a special take in life, and she's making a fruitcake. And basically, the fruitcake reminds her of her life. She starts telling her life story as she makes the fruitcake.
Ah, okay.
And it's not a barrel of laughs, but there's a lot of laughs in it. Yeah, yeah.
What else are you up to?
I do midday a lot. I do the TV3 thing. I have a lot of those kind of little
nudges. And you're still living on the farm and farming.
Oh yeah, and I do the farm as well. Yeah, but I do like my little bit of presenting and my little bit of agony aunting and my little. I love that, and I'd love to do more of that. I thoroughly enjoy doing the.
Well, it obviously. Thing. I mean, you look great.
Oh well, now that doesn't come naturally.
Right.
Can I do a shameless plug?
Well, please do.
Absolute shameless plug. I want to plug this woman in Mullingar. Her name is Jill. And she does Casey, C-A-C-I.
Casey, what's that? Is it a drink or something? Or?
It's not. It's a facelift without surgery. And she's been working on me now for the last couple of weeks. And I have to say, it's amazing. It's painless. It's not very expensive. And if you really want to look $1 million, I would actually urge you. She works out of Mullingar, Cavan, Longford and Ballinia. And if you want to talk to her, you can talk to Jill on 086-826-5570. That's 086-826-5570, and you won't regret it, ladies or gentlemen.
I have to tell you, looking at you here inside in the studio, well, I don't know how it started, but you're wearing well anyway.
Oh, thanks very much.
Well, what do you do to relax, Mary?
Well, if I could relax, that would be wonderful.
If I could wave a magic wand, I do this for a minute. Like, what would you like to do? What would you like to do? Like, if somebody could say, whatever you want to do in life now, what would you like? What would it be?
I would like to present a show or act in a show where I got to wear beautiful clothes and got paid ridiculous, vulgar amounts of money. And then I'd buy more donkeys and more trees.
Do you have donkeys?
Oh, yeah.
Do you? They're lovely animals.
Donkeys.
How many donkeys do you have?
Three. And I'd buy more donkeys and more trees and more useless animals. You know, just animals that are just there to be pretty and looked at and petted and looked after and all of that. And then I'd wear my nice frocks. And then I'd wear my nice frocks. I'd go off and be gorgeous and beautiful. Chance to be a fine thing. And then I'd come back home and I'd throw it all off, put on me wellies and go out and pet me donks and dig for the vegetables and feed the sheep. And that would be the perfect balance for me.
Just being like that.
Yeah.
Do you holiday at home or abroad?
Neither, actually. I haven't had a holiday, I'd say, in 5 years.
On.
No, I got stuck. I went away with another great woman from Mullingar, an acupuncturist called Suzanne Lynch. We went off to Nice last year for 4 days when Gugu Baramajagal was erupting in Iceland, and we were stuck
got
for
stuck.
France for 4 days, 10 days. But it wasn't lovely because we were freaking out to get home, you know, but it was gas. We ended up trekking through, it actually would have made a great documentary, trekking through France to try and get home, and we got home eventually by the ferry and all of that. But I am trying to go this year. I'm going off with Martina Stanley, Dolores from Fair City, for 4 days to France again. We'll give it another go.
Why be 4 days? You need to go for more than 4 days.
No, the trick is, I couldn't afford to. I want to go to a posh place. I want to be very posh and very chic on the south of France. You don't do the south of France.
Mm.
So we decided we go posh and chic for 4 days rather than sort of middle
cheap
of the
and
road
chair for eight.
For eight, yeah. And pretend that we're Lana Turner and
Mary
whoever.
McAvoy, I've thoroughly enjoyed the past hour in your company. Thank you so much for taking the time to come in. May we wish you all the best for the future. You're a lovely woman.
Thank you.
And I look forward to seeing you the next time that you're on the boards anywhere around the Midlands.
Thank you very much.
Mary McAvoy, thank you.